GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. They're close to a deal to raise the federal borrowing limit. President Biden and top Republican negotiators. Talks continue. ABC's Rachel Scott in Washington.
What the Treasury Secretary says, Americans who rely on Social Security and Medicare payments will still get those checks at the beginning of the month. But once that money goes out, the Treasury Department will be left with extremely low resources. The president, he says they are very close to a deal.
The Texas State House tomorrow could vote to impeach State Attorney General Ken Paxton on various allegations, including obstruction and bribery. Russian officials say Ukrainian drones and mortar fire hit Russia's southern Belgorod region bordering Ukraine. Drones attacked a Russian city near Crimea. 37,000 American flags planted by volunteers at the Soldiers and Sailors Monument on Boston Commons this Memorial Day weekend. Navy Vietnam veteran Stephen English.
We never forget the sacrifice of the service members, the veterans, the warriors, and we never forget the sacrifice of their families.
This is ABC News. An Indiana doctor facing a penalty for talking publicly about a patient's abortion.
The reprimand comes from the Indiana Medical Licensing Board, fining Dr. Caitlin Bernard $3,000, finding she went against privacy laws when Bernard talked publicly about providing an abortion to a 10-year-old rape victim from neighboring Ohio, where abortion was banned but still legal in Indiana at the time. The case unfolded shortly after Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Although the board found Dr. Bernard guilty of disregarding privacy laws, they dismissed allegations from Indiana's Republican Attorney General claiming she failed to report child abuse to local authorities. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Walgreens facing a $25 million wrongful death lawsuit over killing a suspected shoplifter in San Francisco last month. Banco Brown, a transgender man accused of shoplifting, but family attorney John Burris today said Brown posed no threat. He was outside the store when a security guard shot him.
He was in a position to shoot or not shoot. And the important part is he did not have to shoot.
Andy Field, ABC News.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Nettner. Here's what you need to know. The Wisconsin Realtors Association says existing home sales in April down 32.5% compared to last year, so it's still a seller's market. The Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay areas all saw home sales drop 31 to 36% in April of this year. It's even worse for homes considered more affordable for first-time buyers. The association says there are 1.7 months of inventory in the $125,000 to $200,000 range and 2 months of inventory in the $200,000 to $350,000 range. This winter, the Great Lakes saw the fourth lowest ice cover since scientists began keeping track a half century ago. Data from NOAA shows the average ice cover was only 6.2% this year, the average over the last 50 years, 24.5%. I'm Jane Mattner. This is Civic Media News.
If you're a motorist of the four-wheel variety, please watch out for those of us in Wisconsin who do their traveling on two wheels. Adjust your mirrors to reduce your blind spots. Allow motorcyclists a full lane width. Use your turn signal when merging or changing lanes. And allow more following distance between you and the motorcycle. Motorists and motorcyclists can work together to achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roads. Zero in Wisconsin. Together we can save lives. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
So much waiting for me.
Yeah, I wanna go outside. I wanna be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council. If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and I'll tell you what, it's more fun than tipping cows. And actually, you shouldn't really tip the cows, okay? They don't tip as easy as they think, and they might kick you in the... Never mind.
Work for you. Join us daily at therickssmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Got into this conversation recently about the American dream, about the American middle class. I was talking to a group, and it came up, the question, you know, who killed it? Who killed off the American dream? Rick, who killed the American middle class? And it centered around this idea of, well, who built the American dream? Who built what we look at as the middle class? I don't usually use that frame of the middle class. I look at a prosperous working class because those of us who work for a living, we're always going to be working class. Some of us do a little bit better than others. Some of us not so much. But the goal is that we all do better, that we all are able to support our families, to lead a good life, one without want, one without need. You know, we're not all going to be Jeff Bezos. We're all not going to be the latest episode of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. But you know what? We're going to lead dignified lives. And it got me to thinking about this, what we've been slammed with, that we're, you know, all middle class and that we're all, you know, we're all projecting. And a number of years back, I had gone on this quest to find one person who agreed that they weren't middle class. And I remember meeting a woman, and it was you know, at a gas pump somewhere, and she made $16,000 a year. I was driving a car that was probably 20 years old and you know, struggling. Someone who was working two jobs trying to make ends meet was really struggling, but believed to her core that she was in the middle class. And her argument for why she believed she was in the middle class is she didn't take any money from the government credit, and she did get kids got school lunch programs, and there were a bunch of those things that she didn't identify as government handouts that she was benefiting from, but she believed. And this, there's this, that frame is, it's really powerful. It's really a very powerful frame. The middle class, you know, the American dream, the white picket fence, you know, the dog barking in the yard, being able to take a vacation occasionally. And it's one that's been really very well crafted for us to believe in. And look, I want there to be that American dream. I want there to be that meritocracy that we were told as kids was possible. That if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you got ahead. But I think about the golden age of what we think of as the middle class, that Norman Rockwell-esque period, my grandparents' period. And what built that? What created that? It wasn't some invisible hand. It wasn't some magic thinking. It was people. It was policy. It was created. It didn't just happen. It isn't natural, because the natural state of things was always rich and poor. A handful of rich people and a whole lot of us broke. A whole lot of us desperate. A whole lot of us living, you know, just hand to mouth, in poverty, hoping to get through just today, let alone the next. But because of policy, because of organizing, because of people, we built this idea, this expectation, this American exceptionalism idea that we're better than that, that there's this middle class, and that workers can get into it. And we did that. No invisible hand did that. No free market ideology did that. Understand, the free market ideology was created to get workers to blame someone other than the boss for their poverty and their desperation. But understand, the pendulum swings. My grandparents' generation built the most powerful, most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. And they did that. They did that on the backs of the New Deal. And the New Deal was built on the power of people, the power of organizing, the power of, well, the citizens, the working class mobilizing. And those workers understood to their core what their power was. And their power was demanding action in their government. And you think about it. You think about the kind of suffering and the kind of pain and stuff that happened during the Depression. And they turned to their government. And for the first time, really, in this country's history, that their government actually did respond. Their government actually did something to move us in a direction to ensure that there was some bit of worker power, that it was there, that it was available. That's incredible to me. And it's one of those things that's so important, and so important in this moment. Because we're living in a moment where that kind of power is necessary. You think back to that New Deal era, the policies that came out of it, the policies that were fought for and demanded for, the fact that people were in the streets. You think about the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, that put millions of people to work during the Depression when there were no jobs. I had, you know, great-grandparents and great-granduncles and you name them, people who benefited from this. They got jobs and they built stuff that, amazingly, still in use today. You think about the Civil Works Administration that focused on high-paying construction jobs that, again, infrastructure that was built from investments back in the 30s, still today. You go through the Federal Housing Administration that made sure that there was affordable housing for people coming out of the Depression, and that there were their non-rip-off kind of lending practices. The Home Ownership Loan Corporation that saved millions of people during the Depression from losing their homes because the government bought up all the mortgages and refinanced them in ways that people could stay in them. I would argue a model we should be looking at for student loan debt. But you can go through all this, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which gave workers the right to collectively bargain for the first time. Interestingly enough, ruled unconstitutional by our Supreme Court at the time. You go through all this, the Public Works Administration, again, went through, you know, communities and built, you know, sewers and water lines, and the kind of things that we need. The Tennessee Valley Authority. Just, you know, incredible investments. Tennessee Valley Authority, we still own today. There was talk for a bit of privatizing it, because, hey, you know what? We got to hock everything off. But you go through and you look at all these investments, all this stuff that they did.
the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, which eventually got people in 1935 the ability to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, conditions. Was it perfect? No. But it was demanded. I look at the NLRA as not you know, the labor panacea, but it was a peace accord. This was a peace agreement between a peace treaty between employers and workers. Because understand, during this period, workers were literally tearing this country apart because they were organized. They were in the streets. They were educated, activated, engaged, angry, and calling for their government to act. 38, you find the Fair Labor Standards Act. Minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, end of child labor, all kinds of stuff. We're moving the country in a positive direction. And why? Because people are demanding it. People are demanding that their government act on their behalf. And millions of people are in the streets. And you think about those advancements. You think about Social Security. The fact that you could retire and not have to work till the day you die was a incredible, monumental step forward. That was done with policy. We had an incredibly regulated economy. You stop and you think about the jobs of the 70s and 80s that were considered those family-sustaining jobs, those good-paying jobs. The trucking industry, where I'm from, was the gold standard of working-class jobs. The most respected middle-class, working-class jobs out there, paid the best, had the most power of all of the working-class jobs out there. Why? Because they were heavily unionized. And in a very bipartisan way, that was destroyed. That was taken away. But I think back to my grandparents. My grandfather, who had an eighth grade education, could provide his family a living wage, could provide a quote-unquote middle-class lifestyle, could move us in a direction that American dream. They bought a small house. They raised their family. But every step of the way, there was government intervention. There was government regulation. And what had to happen? They had to destroy that. And you look Reagan forward. A little bit before Reagan, but Reagan was really the culmination of the entire anti-regulation movement from the New Deal forward. Taking back the wealth class power, their dominance. And you got to give them credit. They've done a great job. They've destroyed what was the most prosperous working class in history. They're moving us back to desperation. And I think back to when I started working. And this is again, one of those when I was a kid. And it's not that long ago. You know, back in 1989, when I started in the LTL, less than truckload freight industry. I started off at $14 an hour. There's no wizardry in that. It was $14 an hour back in 89. You go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have this cute little inflation calculator. In today's dollars, that $14 I was making back then is worth $33.42 today. That's the amazing part of this. Today, that job, that exact job that I had, I started, you know, over 30 years ago, is paying just over $18 an hour. Where's the other $15 that used to go into the worker's pocket? Where did that go? Oh, that's right. We used it to create the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization. We used it to enrich the wealth class. We used it to make the wealthier wealthy. But this is a moment where we need to come back together, where we need to do as my grandparents' generation did and great-grandparents' generation did. Take to the streets and demand better. Organize, stand together and say, you know what? We demand part of the wealth that our labor creates. That's not too much to ask. And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, about where we were, where we are, and where we need to go. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you've got a story you want to share, I want to hear it. If you missed any portion of our program, make sure you download our podcast. Always available wherever you get your podcast, from iTunes to iHeart, Stitcher to Podbean, everywhere in between. Always good stuff. Love to hear your thoughts again. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Labor unions built the middle class, and the middle class built America. That's the message from Teamsters Local 1932, a strong and successful labor union based in San Bernardino that represents over 14,000 hardworking people across the Inland Empire. The Teamsters are ready to help you organize for better pay, increased benefits, and improved working conditions. Reach out to Teamsters 1932 at teamsters1932.org/organize to speak with an organizer today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I was looking through an old contract of my grandfather's. And again, as I said, when I started back in the freight industry, and understand, transportation had been one of auto, transportation, airlines. These were the key working class industries, heavily unionized, good contracts, solid wages. It was, for those who want the middle class frame, it was the heart and soul of the American middle class. It was what was the engine that made the middle class go. It's what built communities. It's the wealth of the entire thing that was able to, you know, have Main Street be able to start little businesses, and it fueled communities. But as I was looking back through my grandfather's Central States Area Tank Truck Agreement from 1967 to 1970, one of these old contracts that, you know, a relative sent to me, I found that, you know, back in 1967, my grandfather was making $3.42 an hour. And you go, ah, that's nothing. Until you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and you look at their little wizardry calculator, the inflation calculator, and you realize that in 1967, that $3.42 was worth $30.05 in today's money. He was making $30 an hour as a truck driver. And you go, well, what are they making today? Well, now understand, he had full health care, didn't pay a dime out of his pocket, nor did I when I started, still don't. He had a full defined benefit pension, didn't contribute a dime to it. He had, you know, 6 weeks vacation. He had, you know, paid sick days. He had all kinds. He had all this stuff that's slowly been eroded away. Truck drivers today are making, you know, $25, $26 an hour. Some I've seen upwards of 30, but you start looking at their health care, goes away. And this is kind of this is a huge problem in the world that we're at. And the frustrating part of this is we can do better than this. We can do better than the world that we're in. And, you know, we're fed this job-killing regulation frame. We're fed this always. And the reality is, without the regulations of that era, you don't have a middle class. You don't have what's in front of us. Let's go to Rob on line one. Rob, how are we doing today?
Good, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. What's on your mind, brother?
You know, I'm just so frustrated lately, you know. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. Gosh darn it, you know, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves of white collars, you know. Like, advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy stuff we don't need. I mean, we're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no Great War, no Great Depression. Like, our Great War is a spiritual war. Our Great Depression is our lives. And we've been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. And we're slowly learning that fact, and we're very, very ticked off.
You know, I just had this conversation earlier today that there's a when I grew up, you had good times, and you had the Waltons that they were poor, they were broke, but they had solid values and core honesty and hard work and those things. And we've morphed into lifestyles of the rich and famous, and now all of the kind of things that you're talking about. And you're right, and I think part of that is that those solid jobs that created that middle class that people thought that they could be part of, they don't exist anymore. And I think back to a kid I met a couple of years ago who said, my only shot is getting this college education that they're trying to take back from me, because my grandparents wanted to go to college, my father wanted to go to college, they couldn't, they ended up back at the mill. He's like, there's no mill for me to go back to, this is it. And I think that's a big part of where we are, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we're consumers. We're the byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazine, television with 500 channels, some guy's name on my underwear, Rogaine, Viagra, Alestra. I mean, if we are God's unwanted children, so be it. But the things you own end up owning you, and I think not enough people are thinking that way.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I appreciate the call, Rob. Thanks, man. Good stuff. That's a big part of this, and the work that we do. Yeah, when I was having this conversation, I had someone who said, I don't find the same satisfaction in the work that I do because I'm struggling. I go home and it's a struggle. It's a constant struggle, not finding the dignity and respect in the work that they do because they're not being able to support their life. Roof over the head, food on the table, clothes on your kid's back, bare necessity stuff. And, we're seeing a lot of this stuff. People are dropping out of traditional work. And this is where, maybe this is the future of all this. To where these jobs, trucking, airline work, the railroads, these were the heart and soul of that labor movement, the heart and soul of that middle class. They're almost poverty wage jobs at this moment. And in the next segment, when we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Michael Belzer. He is the author of an incredible book, Sweatshop on Wheels, The Winners and Losers of Trucking Deregulation, where he goes through and he looks at the industry that I've spent more than 30 years in and the policies from where we created the trucking industry, the ability to regulate it, set rates so that workers could earn a living wage, gave workers the rights to organize and unionize and fight for better wages, hours, conditions, all the way to where we began destroying it, thanks to Jimmy Carter signing the deregulation of not just trucking, but also the airlines. And then ultimately leading to Carter firing the Patco workers and the shot heard across the boardroom that has led to this all-out assault we've seen the last 30-plus years on organized labor. This is a moment. We're living through a moment in history. And the question is, in 20 or 30 years, when we look back at it, which direction will we have taken it? Will this be one of those moments where we tell our grandkids, hey, you know what? We were on the right side of this moment. We fought the fight to make the middle class for you and give you the opportunity to live that American dream that we only slept on? Or is this that moment where we go, well, there was a fleeting moment, there was an opportunity, and we remained divided over it. We remained pitted against each other. Only we will be able to tell. But the reality is, for those who are saying, well, we can't afford it, no, we can. We just haven't prioritized it. And for me, it always comes back to policy. This is why politics matters. This is why we can't continue to be divided the way we are. The wealth class understands divide and conquer. They understand I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. They understand that to their core because they've always been able to do it. It's incumbent on us, you, me, all of us, to stand shoulder to shoulder, maybe with somebody we don't even like, but pushing forward on a goal that's going to move us all forward and help us all do better and help our families do better. That's simple. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this with Dr. Michael Belzer. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day Minneapolis Teamsters walked off the job. It was an historic strike that coincided with the pivotal Toledo Autolite and West Coast Waterfront strikes. Local Teamsters, many of whom later founded the Socialist Workers' Party, had been riding a wave of success, having organized the coal yards in February. Especially important was the development of the Cruising Picket Squad. It became a standard in later CIO battles. That spring, union leaders were determined to organize all the truck drivers and warehouse workers in Minneapolis. By May, Local 574 had over 5,000 members. The trucking bosses refused to deal with the union, and so they walked. The flying pickets toured the city and shut down all trucking. Strikers enlisted the support of the unemployed councils. They also provided the structure for a women's auxiliary that produced important strike literature and bulletins, ran soup kitchens that fed thousands of strikers daily, fought scabs and police on the picket lines, and drove picket trucks. Historian Brian Palmer, author of Revolutionary Teamsters, The Minneapolis Trucker Strike of 1934, notes that strike leaders looked to the example of the Illinois Progressive Miners of America when it came to building the women's auxiliary. They too sought to make women an integral part of the strike, thus encroaching on the male world of waged work. Strike headquarters were established, and as Palmer describes, was a beehive of activity on the eve of the strike as union carpenters and plumbers installed stoves, sinks, and serving counters. Union electricians installed communication wiring. Donations of money, food, vehicles, and gas rolled in as the strike revved up. Local 574 was poised to make Minneapolis a union town.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Mitch McConnell, the sour old goose who heads the Senate Republican caucus, had a hissy fit when the news leaked out that American women are about to have their most fundamental constitutional right taken from them by a cabal of Supreme Court judges. What made Mitch twitch, of course, was not the bad news for women, but the leak. He huffed that revealing the right-wing court scheme to the public was a stunning breach, spewing that it's an attack on the independence of the Supreme Court. Mitch, the so-called Supremes have been meeting behind closed doors specifically to plot an all-out attack on the independence of some 170 million women to control their own bodies. Why aren't you opposing the secrecy rather than supporting the court's subversion of women's liberty? Perversely, the entire Republican leadership is outraged by the leak rather than the attack on women. Right-wing blowhard Ted Cruz, for example, yapped that informing the public, quote, will do lasting damage to the integrity of the court. Ted, you and your ideological ilk annihilated the court's integrity and its legitimacy when you stacked it with a covey of corporate coddling partisan hacks like Alito, Barrett, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Thomas. Then came Senator Mike Lee of Utah, a Trump acolyte, ludicrously blathering that the leak of the judicial plan is despicable. Why? Well, he explained to us commoners, the court, quote, is not a political body. If ignorance is bliss, Mike must be ecstatic. The GOP majority on this court is so immersed in its own partisan biases that it is routinely ruling against workers, the environment, women, voting rights, local communities, and democracy itself. This is Jim Hightower saying, no surprise then that the public trust in the integrity of these arbiters of justice is crashing. If the court won't respect our democratic ideals, the people won't respect the court.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I want to take a special second to thank our exclusive sponsors for this hour, Teamsters Local 1932 in the Inland Empire. You want to check out their website, Teamsters1932.org. They do fantastic work representing more than 14,000 hardworking men and women in the Inland Empire. So shout out to them. Now, you know, I go back to the conversation I had at the group I was speaking to about, you know, the middle class and, you know, what built it and then ultimately what destroyed it. And I came back to the simple reality that we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs that every time we hear regulation, we're supposed to foam. And look, you know, the GOP's done a great job because, you know, I remember, what's her name? Michelle Bachmann, the crazy fun one from Minnesota. She was, you know, job-killing regulation. And they go, but what about the people-killing lack of or the industry-killing lack of? Yeah, never an answer there. But here's the thing. You look at the trucking industry, you look at the airline industry, you look at the, well, every industry we've deregulated. Has it been good for workers or consumers? And the answer is no. And here to share some thoughts on what has happened to the trucking industry, my industry, I've asked Dr. Michael Belzer to come talk with us. Dr. Belzer is a professor of economics at Wayne State University. He has written the book on what happened to my industry. It's titled Sweatshop on Wheels, Winners and Losers in Trucking Deregulations. Dr. Belzer, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
So, you know, I look at that frame, that job-killing regulation, and, you know, again, my first reaction is, you know, what about the people-killing lack of regulation? Your thoughts?
Well, this business about regulation being job-killing is just a slogan that if you repeat it often enough, people begin to believe it. And that's really all it is. Regulation didn't kill jobs. Regulation actually made jobs pretty good. But that said, the regulation that we're talking about is that of the Interstate Commerce Commission, and the Interstate Commerce Commission is no longer alive and with us to defend itself. So we're living in a world now where most regulation that people are talking about is regulation to protect workers and to protect consumers and to protect, in our case, because it's trucking, users of the highway system. It's also true, of course, airlines and a lot of other transportation modes, but we're talking specifically about trucks. We're talking about trucks on the highway and truck drivers working too much, not getting paid enough, and generally being driven into the ground. So all of that has consequences for the public. We have a lot of jobs in trucking, but the jobs in trucking generally are so poor that nobody wants them. And so that's really what's happened. And again, what's really good is that for the last year, the conversation has been changed. The Biden administration changed the way people frame it. And for the first time in my professional life, and I go back even longer than you, it is looking more at the question of the quality of the work, quality of the job. And instead of talking about driver shortage, for example, they talk about a recruitment and retention problem. There's millions of people out there who have commercial driver's license, but simply are not going to use it driving a truck and working 80, 90, 100 hours a week and not getting paid for it.
Yeah, I mean, we took that job from being the solidly, and I hate the frame middle class, but for this argument, we're going to use it, a solid middle class job, one of the better working class jobs at the top end of the working class. Because you go back to the 70s and really even into the 80s, being a truck driver was one of the most respected working class jobs. They had one of the better wage structures, certainly one of the most powerful industries because they were, you know, represented by the Teamsters Union. In fact, when I started in the LTL industry, it was 85% unionized. It's down to about 10% now because of these assaults. And I go back to that frame, that job-killing regulation. All they did by tearing the regulations away from the industry that I'm in is make these jobs much more worse, much, much more desperate. And, well, you know, as your book says, sweatshop on wheels.
Well, the quality of the work has definitely declined. The book documents the first 20 years. And I'll tell you, because it's now, the book was written in 2000. It was published in 2000. So stuff that I wrote then, people asked me on the 20th anniversary of the publication of that book, has anything changed? And I say, no, not really. It's pretty much the same dynamic and continues to go under the ground. What's changed a little bit is that we just have come through this enormously difficult COVID crisis when people began to recognize the significance and the importance of the supply chain, including the truck drivers that move the freight. Now, for a little while there, they were talked up and venerated, and aren't these great people? They are heroes. And now we're right back to where we've been in the past, which is you're lucky you're working, and that's kind of as far as it goes. So the Biden administration introduced a report on the supply chain and a trucking action plan that has actually begun to change the conversation. A, as I said before, it's a recruitment problem, not a driver shortage problem. It's a retention problem, not a driver shortage problem. So by changing that language, they correctly define the nature of the problem, and there's some proposed solutions out there that actually begin to talk about how we can make this work better.
Yeah, I would argue it's not even a retention problem or anything else. It's a use problem. I would argue we misuse our drivers. We misuse the resource in horrible ways by having people sitting around waiting at warehouses for days on end without being paid, waiting at the ports for hours and days on end without being paid. I argue if those were actually employees who you had to be on somebody's clock and they were responsible to pay, they would use that resource much more efficiently and much better, and we would have much more efficient use of our transportation networks. But if as long as they can let this roll down on the back of someone else, they're going to abuse the heck out of the guy at the bottom of the hill.
Well, that's why I used to, as I think you probably know, I was a truck driver before I retired to be an academic. And now I can't seem to retire because this problem is still not solved. So here I am. So I spent over a decade and about 750,000 miles on the road as a truck driver. And I was always a teamster in those days. And that goes from about the mid-70s to mid-80s. So I was there during the time when trucking was regulated and it was unionized in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% overall for the whole industry. And that is what made it unnecessary to worry about laws like the minimum wage and that kind of stuff, because truck drivers are getting paid so much more. That is no longer the case, and we have truck drivers now paid considerably less than the minimum wage. And especially if you add up all the time that gets wasted, which is what you just talked about. So from the economic perspective, consumers will consume an infinite amount of a free good. And so if the free good is the truck driver's time, and frankly, the motor carrier's time, because there is a cost at the truck not going anywhere, and sitting and waiting to get unloaded or loaded, they will use an infinite amount of that free time, and that essentially accentuates the nature of the problem. So as long as that time is free, they will continue to waste it. Right. That's not going to change. None of that practice is going to change until drivers are paid for it. There is a bill that Andy Levin, the congressman from Michigan, has put forward, and I'm very supportive of that bill, and it's a bill to delete the minimum, the maximum hours for the overtime provision that exempted truck drivers from the overtime provision of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is where the minimum wage and 40-hour workweek comes from. Now, that's a major move. That is remarkable that it took so long for that to happen. But in 1980, when deregulation occurred, there actually had been a study done by the Carter administration on the minimum wage, and it's the last time it was ever done. So that's now 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago. But they concluded that for trucking specifically, we don't need to change the minimum wage law for trucking because everybody's unionized, so not to worry. So they're getting paid miles and hours, not to worry, everybody's fine. And so at the very moment that they declared in 1980, we don't have a problem because the union represents all these people. That was also the high watermark of the union, because very quickly unionization went down, not because people didn't want it, but because the exempt sector, which is the agricultural commodities and raw materials commodities sector, flowed in as an industry, flowed into the common carrier sector, which is what I worked in, and they just creamed the good paying freight, thinking that they were going to continue to make that big money. And of course, as it turns out, they didn't end up making the big money either, because they essentially competed away all the conditions under which we can attribute their successful pay and conditions. They stripped that away, and the competition took away all that pay, and you ended up with the situation that you have right now, which is truck drivers and trucking companies sitting around waiting for shippers or consignees to let them load or unload or get whatever they need to do. And so they essentially become warehouses on wheels.
Yeah.
So continuing ongoing problem.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Dr. Michael Belzer, professor of economics at Wayne State University, author of the book Sweatshop on Wheels, Winners and Losers in Trucking Deregulation. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at the book. Highly suggest it. Good read. Understand it's over 20 years old. And I would argue, as bad as it is in the book, it's actually gotten worse in real life. And I talked earlier, Doctor, about the fact that when I started in the industry back in 89, I was making $14 an hour. And when you do the little wizardry calculator, it's over $33 an hour in today's money. I looked back at my grandfather's contract book from 1967. He was making $3.42 an hour back then, which would be over $30 in today's money. And I know today they're paying a little bit over $18 to start. And I asked the question, where'd the rest of that money go? Because we were told that when we deregulate this stuff, and so we're told when we deregulate everything, we're going to get better service, it's going to be cheaper, and the workers are going to do just fine. And I remember arguing that deregulation is going to kill wages, it's going to kill jobs, and the consumers aren't going to do particularly well. But the owners in the wealth class, they're going to do fine. I'm curious, you know, how's that worked out?
Well, it's kind of complicated. So this is why I decided to study this when I went to graduate school after driving a truck for 10 years, trying to figure this out. There is, to some extent, remember, I just mentioned that when deregulation occurred in 1980, the exempt sector, which again is agricultural goods, moved in quick and grabbed the business. And they creamed the truckload freight outside of the common carrier companies. So by the time you got in 89, all the damage was done. I would look at it from my perspective and say, well, you're one of the guys who came along after everything had already gone to hell. And I can tell you how far it had gone to hell, because I was paid as a Teamster in 1980, something around $13 an hour in 1980 money, and the inflation rate was really high then. So that's equivalent to something closer to $40 or $50 an hour today. That's what I was paid back then. And I can remember when my pay was cut and then frozen, and that was all from the competition from the non-union sector. So the non-union companies came in, stripped the freight out, and the Reagan administration gave companies the green light to break unions. And so they went full bore after the Teamsters. Teamsters survived as a union, but they lost a great fraction of the trucking industry. So now, as you've mentioned, of the trucking industry, maybe about 10% is unionized. They, in fact, in the late 1990s, they quietly moved United Parcel Service, the census quietly moved United Parcel Service out of the trucking industry and called it a courier, put it in with FedEx, and said it's a courier company, not a trucking company. So right there, the industry lost something like 300,000 union members, because they're now in courier. So all of that said, this is essentially a complete restructuring. The idea was that this would make the transportation cheaper, and it would benefit consumers. In some sense, it did, but it benefited consumers in general on the backs of truck drivers. And that's essentially what we've looked at now, what happened. Truck drivers' compensation went down big time, in the neighborhood of 50% now over the last 40 years. And that money went down badly enough that, or strongly enough, that the consumers saved some money. But you know, there's a lot of consumers who are also truck drivers. And they're like Henry Ford's workers, who Henry Ford said, I'll give them all $5 a day, when $5 was a lot of money, so they can buy their own cars,
right,
that I'm going to make for them. Well, you couldn't pay for it anymore on what a truck driver makes. So that's really what we're down to. We're down to something in the minimum wage or less. And in fact, with all that unpaid time, unpaid non-driving time, waiting for hours to get loaded or unloaded, I would argue we're, truck drivers are working for quite a bit less than minimum wage. The minimum wage would be a big boost.
No, I'm right there with you. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, I'm feeling a little bit more hopeful, probably more than I have in my more than 30 years of activism, because I'm starting to see people who are coming out of this pandemic saying, you know what, I've had enough of, you know, fill in the expletive. I'm curious how you view these stories now. You see Amazon, you see Starbucks, you see, you know, the Apple workers. You're starting to see this kind of sense of, we're not going to take it anymore. We're ready to organize. Are you hopeful for the future?
Well, what do they say? Cautiously optimistic? How's that sound? Not so hot. Yeah, I think it's good. What I'm hearing is a couple of things. First of all, we're kind of in this take this job and shove it era, as far as that's concerned, because right now people are a lot of people are working for so little money that they are indifferent about whether they keep the job or not, because really they're getting paid less than minimum wage for the number of hours they put in. So why bother? Why not just go to work two McDonald's jobs or go into construction or just do something else? And one of the things that makes it bad like that is that in trucking, because of the Fair Labor Standards Act exemption for the overtime provision, they've not been required to comply. They have not been required to pay people for all the time that they work. And they have not been required to actually record legitimately the number of hours they work. If you compare the rules that the Department of Labor runs under compared to the rules that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration runs under, the definition of work, they're starkly different. And one of the things you can find in my website, you're free to circulate that if you like, it's michaelbelzer-saferates.com. It's in the signature that I've sent you. You can put that up if you like. In there, I have some presentations that I've made in recent years where I've tried to show exactly where this is coming from. And the bottom line is the Department of Labor's definition of work and Department of Transportation's definition of work are drastically different. Everybody who comes into trucking from another job is got in their minds a definition of work like the one they have for every other job. That is, if you're a production worker, you punch in, you punch out, you get time and a half after 40, and you get paid at least minimum wage. Well, that doesn't apply to trucking, and that's something that I pointed out repeatedly in Sweatshops on Wheels, and is now even more sharply true today as a result of this labor market disruption that we've had around COVID than it was ever before. So I think that's what's happening, and I think a lot of workers are saying, you know what, I don't need to put up with this anymore. You're either going to treat me right, pay me right, or I'll just go do something else. And that's what they're doing.
And hopefully they take that mindset and we begin to organize and make workplaces better. At least that's my thought. The website, michaelbelzer-saferates.com. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Dr. Belzer, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us down the road.
Good. Let's find some good news to talk about.
I hope we do. Appreciate the time, Dr. Belzer. Let's take a quick break. I'd love to get your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day we lost one of the giants of the U.S. labor movement, A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph spent his life working for black workers and the cause of labor. He organized the first national black union to be recognized by the American Federation of Labor, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The fight for union recognition took 12 years, and the porters signed their first contract in 1937. Randolph went on to lead the effort to desegregate war industries and armed services during and after World War II. He was one of the leading organizers of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, one of the most memorable actions of the civil rights movement. He also worked tirelessly to break down discrimination within the labor movement. He was elected the first black vice president of the AFL-CIO in 1955. Randolph's dedication to the cause of labor was summed up when he said, quote, "The essence of trade unionism is social uplift. The labor movement has been the haven for the dispossessed, the despised, the neglected, the downtrodden, the poor." But Randolph also consistently declared that no movement for social justice can be complete unless it is also inclusive. While organizing for the desegregation of the war industries during World War II, Phillips argued, quote, "Equality is the heart and essence of democracy. Freedom and justice, equality of opportunity in industry, in labor unions, schools and colleges, government, politics, and before the law. There must be no dual standard of justice, no dual rights, privileges, duties, or responsibilities of citizenship. No dual forms of freedom." Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. Are you underpaid and overworked? Is a living wage and employee benefits like affordable health care more of a dream than a reality for you and your family? If so, it's time to form a union. Don't be denied the wages and benefits you deserve. Come together in a union with the power of numbers. A union is not a privilege, it's your right, and it will make a difference. Contact Teamsters Local 1932, a powerful and successful labor union in San Bernardino, by visiting teamsters1932.org/organize to start today. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any of our programs, make sure you grab the podcast. Always available, always there. Subscribe, like, share, all of that stuff. Comment. Kind of to wrap this up, the idea, this is simple. Things were really bad. You go back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. You go back to the robber baron era of the 1880s, 1890s. Things were really bad. Life was short. Life was difficult. It was hard. We lived through a depression that was even harder. A generation fought, bled, and died to build a prosperous working class that they were to pass on to their children and grandchildren. And the moneyed interest clawed it all back. We are now reliving a moment in history. Wealth inequality in this country right now is right back to where it was in those good old days of the 80s and 90s. We are reliving the golden era of the robber baron. Only our robber barons are our media figures like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk over at Twitter. Bezos owns the Washington Post. Bill Gates owns Microsoft. We now have our Gilded Age robber barons. And life may not be as difficult as it was, but it is difficult for a lot of people. We have an opportunity right now to learn the lessons, to organize, to fight and demand dignity, respect, better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities. We can do that. We can learn those lessons, we can move forward, and we can do it together if we can stop being easily divided and pitted against one another, if we choose to. But it's going to take all of us. It's going to take you. It's going to take me. It's going to take us demanding our political leaders to do our bidding, to do our work, not the wealth class. That's simple. Appreciate you being here. Thanks so much. If you miss any of the program, podcast, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming ABC on the Civic News Media app.